Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to the Sports Pro Podcast. My name is Owen Connolly. I'm the editor at large at Sports Pro. Hope you're well. Very happy to be joined once again by Sports Pro Deputy Editor Sam Karp. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Owen. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Sam. Not too bad. Welcome back to the podcast, New York Times global sports reporter Tariq Panja. Hi, Tariq.
Yeah, it's been about 2 days, Owen. So, yep, nice to be back again.
And we've brought the boss out this time as well, Sports Pro Managing Director Nick Meacham. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Owen. It's taken Tariq 2 days to get back on. It's taken me over 2 years. So you go.
Well, then we must have something big to talk about then. This is the second or third time I think I've rescheduled the podcast this week because it has been a quite insane week in the business of football. The launch in the dead of night here in European time of a new European Super League concept. And the early unraveling of the same concept 2 days later. It has been quite extraordinary. It's left as many questions as answers about the future of European football more generally. But I guess I'm going to try and unpack what the hell happened, why it happened. We've got Matt Slater from The Athletic who's going to offer his reflections in a little while as well. But yeah, I mean, where do we start, Tariq? What's... you know, you and I, you just alluded to it there. We sat down and had a chat about the timeline and some of the motivations, some of the political machinations that were going on. You know, hubris is funny, but it seemed very serious at that point. What I guess the thing we're going to come to is whether this is incompetence or part of a wider strategy that we hadn't seen. But, you know, what are the events of the last 24 hours as we're talking been like?
I think it's a whirlwind. You know, I've never seen a news cycle that fast. I mean, for example, Ed Woodward resigned as the chief vice chairman of Manchester United yesterday. In any normal day, that is a massive story. It still is a massive story. But in the middle of this, it's a paragraph.
Yeah.
Ed Woodward's gone because this was going to, this shook, you know, European football to its foundation. And if you're shaking European football, you're shaking world football. This is a sport that millions of people watch. It was going to be changed forever should this thing have gone ahead. And it made, you know, Ed a bit of a footnote in what normally would have been, I don't know, a 1,000-word story, and we'd be talking about it, breaking news, Ed Woodward is gone. And that lasted all about, what, a minute, because then you have Manchester United have withdrawn from the Super League. So it's just been wild, hasn't it? And I think it would take us some time, even for us who've been covering it, to kind of spool out and sort of gather our thoughts and think about what happened in a kind of clear manner, because so much has gone on. But I want to go back to the launch. I find that still just astounding how awful the launch was. Yes, the story leaked, of course. When you have that many people involved, that's going to be a risk. But there didn't seem to be any plan for a leak, which was bound to happen. And then when they did launch, why the hell would you launch this project that is going to change the face of European football when everybody's in bed? It was insane. And then we don't hear from these people at all for another 24 hours. And the only person who appears is Florentino Perez in a sort of the right stuff style tabloid talk show, again in the middle of the night, being allowed to speak, you know, untruth after untruth about this program. And I think the people who he's in bed with, the other clubs, I think some of them were wincing as well by Tuesday morning.
Absolutely. Nick, you shared a few thoughts yesterday about the comms strategy. And I think, you know, one of the things that a few people came to you and said, once you detailed some of those thoughts, was the quality of the comms strategy in some respects reflects the quality of the idea or the level of thought that had gone into the concept, the depth of it. But equally, you know, it was so thin. And when there was going to be so much interest around it, there was some extraordinary, almost calculated for maximum negative effect things that happened. Like the only comment you got from club officials on the Manchester City and Arsenal websites came from executives who worked for Manchester United. Or, you know, among the only comment, there was no comment from those clubs. You had absolutely no one lined up to advocate for this, apart from Florentino Perez in his kind of new nightly talk show, which is another casualty of the week. I would have tuned in to see that for a little while. But there just seemed to have been no thought given to this and to the succession of events. And that will be, I suppose, what most people will remember of it, aside from, you know, the kind of lurch that they went through.
Yeah, I mean, the communication, the delivery, Tarek already touched upon on a few bits as well. But yeah, it was basically as bad as it could have been. And the question is either they had the worst advice ever given to them, or they never took any in the first place, or their egos got in the road of it all and ignored the advice they were given. And it's probably the latter, I would imagine. I mean, the aspects of the communication that they didn't even, we still don't actually really know what the plan actually was. We know conceptually there was going to be 15 clubs. They never outlined where these three others were going to come from that they had mapped out. And they looked to launch in August. They emphasized that basically they wanted to have more control and more power rather than emphasize what the benefits were going to be to fans, and that the communication was just all about the benefits that the owners will get from this project, which that is the last people that people want to know about who's going to benefit from. They don't want to know that we're helping the billionaires get richer. Mm. And that was actually the message that was going out. So it's just extraordinary that some of that wasn't thought through at all. I mean, I think Martin Ziegler was the one who pointed it out, but he found or pointed out the PR company that was involved, and their biggest advocate was Boris Johnson. And I'm not sure what to take from that other than they obviously wanted to try and take a political stance with the PR strategy that they were trying to put in place. But I think if they did, it just came all too late, and they were on the back foot before it even begun.
Yeah. And, you know, we are insiders here. We get a bit inside baseball about some of this stuff, but none of the usual suspects in sports campaign PR were anywhere near this. Some of them were contracted by people who were opponents of this. And I think in terms of how quickly the counter messaging started circulating, that was pretty apparent.
I mean, La Liga was on the front foot from the beginning. I remember receiving comms from their PR team. They were partnering up with, I think it was Brand Finance, to outline the negative brand impact and value that it would this initiative would be taking off the respective brands involved, and it was in the billions. That whole, the way that they went about it and the way that everyone else reacted around it was everyone else was on the offensive and they were on the back foot from the very beginning. And their main messaging about the benefit of this was, to quote, "Oh, it was going to generate $4 billion a year." Okay, well, that again doesn't, no one is concerned about that other than maybe in the sports biz world, because we love to know numbers of where you're going to generate this income. Mm. But those numbers just didn't add up. Like, they were something like 50% more than what Champions League annual revenues are. And they're starting from a standing start, and they're starting allegedly in 4 months' time with zero partners on the books. Like, you can't go sprouting numbers without any way of substantiating them like that.
Yeah. Sam, the other thing that we didn't really see from this project was a vision for the rest of the game. It was very cursory. We heard a few things about how, we heard a few of the issues that sport is facing, that football is facing, more specifically about the tastes of younger audiences. And there was an extremely, almost insultingly brief line about establishing a women's equivalent as soon as practicable. But again, did that kind of add to the sense that there had not been very much consideration of this beyond the kind of bargaining tool until perhaps shortly before we were expecting to see these UEFA reforms announced on Monday?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you allude to there, the sort of the inclusion of a reference to women's competition in the future just seemed like a kind of, you know, a throwaway in and amongst everything to kind of score some brownie points with everyone, which ultimately it just felt like was never going to happen. Whereas the whole thing was framed, as Nick kind of pointed to, they wanted more autonomy, more control, more money. There were some allusions in there into how it might help the wider game. They were talking about generating solidarity payments, which were going to be much larger than what are currently generated by UEFA. But as Nick kind of alluded to, there was no indication of where that was going to come from, who they had on board to help them achieve that. So yeah, I mean, as I say, it just sort of felt like from the offset that there was extreme incompetence attached to this, which is kind of, you know, it's almost hard to believe when you've got, I don't want to say 12 clubs, I want to keep referring to them as 12 owners. It's kind of 12 blokes ultimately in a room who have come together and put this idea together. And yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, it's almost unfathomable to me that you have, you know, those 12 brains and they've got this so wrong. And they haven't kind of, they've underestimated so many things from what the reaction was going to be to kind of the size of the task in front of them, in terms of whether it was the legal battle, in terms of whether it was the various contracts that were going to have to be drawn up. And as Nick was just, you know, the various things that the governing bodies and leagues that are there now sort of organize anyway, and these that they were going to go and have to do on their own. Yeah, it just reeked of incompetence to me. And, you know, to some that might be surprising, but as Jordan Gardner argued in a column on the Sports Pro pages the other day, maybe it shouldn't be that surprising given, you know, the amount of debt that the clubs involved currently find themselves in.
Well, this was interesting, the point that Jordan made, because, you know, he said that there wasn't really any attempt to solve for anything beyond their own problems. They were going for, I think the expression he used was low-hanging fruit, and it's obviously a pretty bold attempt to grab at that, but equally they weren't changing that much about the model. I come back to the women's point, Tarek, in part because that's a huge growth opportunity for football in that it is coming from a pretty low base and you're using established brands and you've seen and established teams and you've seen pretty rapid growth in the last few years. And for that to be so kind of, you know, such an afterthought just suggests that the primary motivation for this was the bottom lines of these teams, which again, just feels like a strange thing to have allowed to advance this far without any thoughts as to what the wider consequences would be.
Yeah, the thing is, it wasn't last minute. That's very clear, because if you remember, the Super League story, with details of Super League story, leaked with us and others in January. So we're what are we now? April. That's a few months. And the reference, this is that model. I can recognise the documents we saw in this model. So in those documents there was one line about women's football. So in 3 months they haven't added anything or tried to flesh that out a bit, and that just kind of shows, I think it kind of shows what we currently have as well. I think women's football remains an afterthought. There's a lot of talk about it, but I think the way it's organized, maybe a bit more money thrown towards it, but it is a bit rubbish. There isn't an effort to do anything. I mean, we're getting the broadcast contracts, we're getting all of these things in, like, to bells and whistles. But in terms of the fundamentals of what this is and big ideas, what they've essentially done is slapped it on the back of men's football and said, "Right, you're going to do this too." It's not great. You're seeing sponsors, etc., coming into it. But what about the big ideas about the women's game? To me, it doesn't look particularly interesting. What we're seeing is a stockpiling of talent in a few teams, like we've unfortunately had in men's football, but organically that is happening in women's football from the off. I just saw Barcelona keep releasing social media posts about how good their women's football team is, but I dare say it's too good because they're thrashing everyone. I think there was stat they put out the other day that they scored something like 122 goals and conceded four. That's not a competition. That's just like humiliating the opposition. That's not very interesting at all. I think there's whoever's running the women's game, I don't think anybody is, should be thinking about distribution of talent, making the competition interesting. You don't just need to just say, you know, whack on a Barcelona or Real Madrid or Manchester United shirt, and, you know, we'll give you a bit more money and you're off to the races. It's just not very interesting. And like you said, these guys had an opportunity with a blank sheet of paper to do something. Equally, if you're going to do a Super League, it doesn't have to be the same teams, does it? Wolfsburg, for example, were an extremely successful women's football team. They would be in a women's Super League if there was a European version. Lyon, for example, another one. This hasn't been thought through correctly. Something else that I found kind of interesting is, like, yeah, they are 12 blokes, but they're 12 extremely wealthy people in their own right. Obviously, they made their money in different ways. Some of them inherited it. Some of them made it in business that has got nothing to do with football. However, they are extremely wealthy and they do have the resources to buy extremely clever people. Some of the best strategists in the world, right? So it beggars belief that they didn't do it. The firm involved, or the consultancy involved in putting this together, is Key Capital Partners in Madrid. I don't know that much about them, but presumably they're successful enough to be given this contract. They're extremely close to Florentino Perez. And JP Morgan Chase had, you know, jumped through a lot of hoops to put this together, right? That's why I find all of what's happened and the great unraveling really, really confusing. One of the issues, though, is I think that's Wednesday. In terms of having signatures on contracts, they were about 7 or 8 this time last week, not 12. So it shows there was a small group to get it this far, maybe because they didn't want leaks and things like that. Or you don't. In football, there's a great degree of mistrust. And they'll... Yeah, unfortunately, I think there always will be. So I think there was only a half a dozen, if maybe even fewer, who were taking the lead with this. Real Madrid, Manchester United, Liverpool, and maybe Arsenal, AC Milan. I count as one team, given the Gazidis element here. And then you then take it to the others. I think some signed as late as Friday and Saturday morning, in order to get to this point. But then when you get to that point, you also then get to the point where you engage the communications departments of these teams as well. And I think they were bought in very, very late in the day. I don't think they were ready to launch on Sunday. I don't think they wanted to launch on Sunday. I think they felt they had to launch on Sunday, given Monday's Champions League announcement and the crazy position that Andrea Agnelli found himself in, basically doing the dirty on two organizations that he sat on. He would have had to vote on this or be in the meeting, the UEFA executive committee on Monday on the Champions League. And then on Friday, he's chairing a meeting of the board of the European Club Association, 247 members, 227 of whom are going to be absolutely screwed should this thing go ahead with 20 teams. It was a totally untenable position for the guy. And it would have leaked. So they should have thought this through, what to do when it leaks and how to react, and they didn't.
You're listening to the Sports Pro Podcast.
You know, it's interesting, Tarek mentioned, you know, some teams signing up as late as Friday. I think you can kind of see that in the nature of some of the statements that have been pushed out in terms of the explanation for why they did it. So you look at, you know, you talk about the drivers that were there and the ones that were leading, and they're obviously the ones thinking, you know, we want to make much more money here. And then you have a statement like Tottenham's, for example. You know, it's, you can question this as much as you want, read into it as much as you want, saying, you know, we did this because we didn't want to be left behind. So, you know, you've on one side you've got the drivers, and then the other side you've got those guys who are thinking, all right, well, if we don't go and do this, then what's going to happen to us? I think it was similar with Chelsea. I know some of the reporting around Chelsea pulling out, whoever was doing the briefing was saying that for Roman Abramovich, the motivation had never been money. So yeah, read into that as much as you want, but it does kind of create this interesting dynamic again, where you do have those, even though it was the 12, you have these 15 founding members, there are still a handful in there who were the ones sort of driving it, and then sort of almost almost saying to these other ones, well, you've got to come with us because this is what's happening. This is where the money is going to be. And then you've also got this other side of it where out of all of this, I guess the two clubs that have come out with the most credibility probably are PSG and Bayern Munich. Somehow they've managed to look like the good guys when over the last decade they've kind of created a bit of a monopoly in their own domestic leagues. As soon as those two kind of pulled out, two names that you would have thought would have been on the packaging from the start, it immediately lost a lot of credibility. But there's just a lot of interesting dynamics there in terms of, you know, the clubs that were driving this, the ones that said they were there because they felt they had to be, and then, you know, those that kind of rejected it from the outset.
Yeah, I think there's two important points there. One is this misalignment of incentives for the teams who are involved, which is something I got into with Matt. But also the fact that as soon as you have PSG and Bayern not signing up, and whether that was, you know, what their motivations would have been down the track, we don't know. Bayern, certainly the fan ownership element of that would probably have prohibited it. But they might have been able to coax the whole thing back into the existing setup in a way that was more palatable. PSG, there's a political element. There's the fact that, you know, there's shared ownership with beIN Sports, who are obviously a major rights holder of existing competitions. There's the World Cup element. And as I say, this is also something that Matt and I talked about. But the other thing, Nick, that is interesting to read is whether this was premature or whether this was someone getting cold feet. Because, you know, a few people made the point at the start of the week when it was kind of, how serious do we take this? JP Morgan are not in the habit of underwriting big loans unless they've seen some of the sums, at least some of them, but at least they've worked out some way that they can justify it. There was a lot of talk about there being a big media partner perhaps involved. And, you know, do we think, could that have been bluster? Could there have been someone who had given something that was a less firm guarantee than was necessary at this stage and that was easy to walk away from? I mean, again, it comes down to malevolence and competence and timing and all the rest of it, and why this came out so half-baked. But what are your thoughts there?
I mean, the key thing here and the key player in all of this is JP Morgan. The fact that they have backed this, they're not a tin pot operator. They would have done what they need to do to work out and make sure they're not risking themselves adversely for this project. So the question is, what were they banking against? And I don't think it would have just been some numbers on a spreadsheet. They would have been, I think the numbers were being reported, correct me if I'm wrong, about $6 billion of total cash that was going to be used from JP Morgan into this project, with I think it was about $2 or $3 billion up front, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of hundred million from as a sort of initial payment to help. What was the quote? I think it was to get through the COVID period. I mean, that didn't even make any sense to begin with. But they wouldn't put that money on the table unless they had something that to offset that against, something legitimate. And there's two things that they really would be. One is a big global media rights deal that was signed in principle with a major, major broadcaster. I mean, we could speculate all we want. It could have, but you saw all of the major guys pretty quick to step away and lengthen themselves or distance themselves from the possibility. So you saw DAZN, you saw BT, you saw Amazon. But there's obviously speculation on who else it could have been if that was there. If it wasn't there, again, having an August deadline for this is just all the more mental. And if it wasn't there, then what assets were the clubs putting forward to act as security for this sort of loan? Because they would have had to put something. And they're already so heavily in debt, most of these clubs. What have they got to put down that they can use as a significant enough security that JP Morgan's willing to do it? And I don't think JP Morgan would ever do this on a pure punt.
Yeah, it's almost certainly TV rights. There's no other option but TV rights, if you think about it, because if you look at Barcelona, Real Madrid, their model in a way wouldn't, they're already so heavily leveraged, Barcelona in particular, there is no way they'll be able to borrow any more on top of their own assets. They're having to repay their current liabilities, right? You know, we've been reporting about their financial crisis. It has to be the over-the-top broadcast contract for the event. And I think the JP Morgan, the current deal, I think it's a bridging loan. I think it's a bridge in order to secure against whatever this TV contract was going to be. But if you're going to talk about numbers, one of the things that was interesting in the press release and one of their kind of talking points, there are two talking points, I think. One, this is going to save football, pandemic, financial crisis. If this doesn't happen, we're all screwed. Turn your TVs off. Just play in the garden with your mates. There's no more football on TV, right? That was the one message. And the other one, which you alluded to, was this thing called solidarity payments. And you said it works out. I did a bit of number crunching and it worked out 435 million euros a year. And they said it's a lot more than UEFA currently pays. And if you're going to use the word solidarity, then yes, it is more than what UEFA pay, because I think UEFA's amounts to around 200 million, maybe a bit less, around 200 million, say half, maybe a bit less. So yeah, it's significant compared to UEFA. But then you have to unpack what we're talking about. You don't just say solidarity. Here you go, lads, 435 million for the rest of European football. You guys who are, you know, looking at us holding the glass. What are UEFA paying for at the moment? Who are they paying? They're paying at least 64 teams in the Europa League and Champions League, right? 32 in each at the moment. You're talking about paying 20 teams. So you're losing 44 teams who are getting paid at the moment. So where's that money coming from? And then you're going to diminish the value of domestic television rights. Premier League, Serie A, La Liga, Bundesliga, all those rights, they're going to be diminished. Premier League, for example, you're going to get rid of the race for the top four. It's the only interesting thing this season. Very compelling. But if that doesn't exist, you don't have a product or anything that anyone wants to really tune in to watch unless it's going to be your team. And then you're going to drop these six teams who are already the richest into the Premier League again, who are going to be even richer. It's going to be really boring. And then I saw Florentino Perez talk about, well, it's not just solidarity payments. We're going to be buying your players. So you're going to be getting all our largesse. So what he's then saying is 15 permanent members of this Super League are going to be professional football's elite clubs. And the hundreds of teams under that, I think Everton, Aston Villa, I don't know, Sevilla, whoever's not in this, Bayern Munich even, at the moment who aren't in this, you can all act as our farm teams. You can be the great sort of talent farm that will populate our teams, and we're going to pat you on the back and give you a few quid for the privilege. That is a real, real indictment of where they see the future of European football, isn't it?
Mm. And the thing that I still struggle with, and certainly in the medium term, Sam, if we're looking at 3 to 5 years, however long it would take to get something like this on its feet, particularly once PSG and Bayern were there to create, you know, to maintain the Champions League as an alternative rival product, which effectively they had done by not joining. But the thing I really, really struggle with is how in any way this competition immediately becomes bigger than the Champions League when you think about how far and how deep the roots of European club football go. The appeal to various clubs, the appeal to different countries who aren't involved. There's no Portuguese teams, there's no Dutch teams, there's no Russian teams. There's none other than three European teams, there's no teams. No Turkish teams. How it immediately becomes a bigger broadcast product on the back of the names that are involved. I mean, the International Champions Cup, with great respect to what they've built in pre-season there, is not bigger than the Champions League. I really struggle to get my head around that. And again, it kind of comes back to this thing of they are solving a problem for themselves, which is they get to keep more of this money for themselves. But they are not communicating how this ends up being better for the world of football. And it's like they've said, they've heard this line from another rights holder. Oh, this will grow the sport and it will be better for everyone. But they're talking about football, which is by many multiples the biggest global sport. And, you know, although the biggest commercial properties might not reside within it, it's got the biggest commercial potential over the next few years.
Yeah, that was, believe me, I struggled with that as well. And I was actually writing about UEFA's latest accounts today and sort of looking at that. I think Nick mentioned it earlier, how the Super League was supposedly going to bring in $4 billion a year. And UEFA's accounts last year say that they made about $2.7 billion from their club competitions alone. So you're sort of, you're immediately thinking how you make that €1.3 billion gap. You know, how on earth are you making that up? And, you know, as you say, those 20 teams have gone, but if the Champions League is still there, all those fans of those clubs that are still competing in that competition, they're not going to sack off watching the Champions League so that they can start watching this Super League instead. You know, it just feels like another way where they haven't really thought it through properly. They haven't thought about who their audience is going to be. It's just kind of, it goes back to the press release. I think Perez alluded to 4 billion football fans globally. They're just under the assumption that 4 billion football fans globally are going to tune into this Super League and they're going to be able to monetize them. So yeah, as you say, there were a lot of figures banded about around it and just not enough substance about how they were going to get to that.
I would just add that I think if you put on the positive hat here and let's go best case scenario rather than we can easily write it off now, even easier now because considering its situation. But what we've seen generally in the sports marketing space, the fundamental shift of fandom from clubs to players. You know, I think it's been well documented where the Ronaldo effect of when, for example, he moved from Real Madrid to Juventus and literally they lost 1 million fans off of their social accounts and 1 million popped up on Juventus the next day. That is a common trend we're seeing where fans are following athletes over following clubs. Now, there's obviously an inherent tribalism in various markets, but at an international level, when you don't have that innate, say, connectivity to living in that place and that destination, the international landscape becomes much more, I guess, flippant to jump team to team depending on where the team is. And you see that in the States with LeBron James is a great example of that as well. So you can see where if this league was able to build the best league in the world with the most money, and they would be without doubt having the best players in the biggest game in the world, the fandom would build. You know, you would obviously really, really piss off a lot of people, but the scale of opportunity of growth would be extraordinary. So that's the best case in terms of scaling of audiences and fans and so forth. There was an opportunity where the growth could be incredible. And then the ultimate result would be the revenues, the money would be shared between these 20 clubs versus sharing it across for example, the UEFA pot. The net effect obviously is that UEFA's revenues would plummet in terms of the money they make from Champions League, and everyone else would be in a worse situation. But this situation, the league in isolation, there's a world where that could have been incredibly successful, but we'll obviously never know. But there would have been so many repercussions off the back of that, which have been well documented, that I'm very glad it hasn't.
Yeah, I mean it's. You know, there is the ethical dimension to this, which I think most of us will take as read, that this was a kind of a hostile private takeover attempt of the World Game and stuff. But it does feel a bit, Tarek, like we've seen a bit of the workings, and as Nick says, there's a gravitation towards athlete-led, individual-led marketing at shallower. So I guess you mitigate for it if you try and keep as much of it as you can in a closed system, because obviously if Ronaldo at 38 decides I'm done playing for Juventus, I want to go home and play in Lisbon for 2 years, then you've suddenly got him living, you know, operating outside of that system as well. But do you think that the prospect of something like this happening again outside the system, has that receded for now? Is this threat still going to exist, and are we going to kind of see I mean, we've already seen it a bit this week because we've got a more, you know, concentrated, consolidated Champions League. We've got a few more teams. We've got a couple of these coefficient places, which might as well be called legacy places. Where do we think the roadmap is for this idea now?
I think it's a good question, that, actually, in terms of what does this happen again? And also in terms of what football represents, because you saw that mass uprising. I say that in the markets where these teams are, particularly in England, to Nick's point. I mean, these fans are, you know, a guy in Dubai might really like this, but I don't know if I really heard from, I don't know if we heard from those people in the markets that they're targeting. Because to me, it doesn't seem like the domestic supporter is a consideration for what they want to do. And perhaps if I was there, I'd be really disappointed with their fair weather supporters overseas who didn't really cheer and support this scheme, because there wasn't any support on social media. I didn't see any. Maybe they were expecting a mass uprising in Bangalore and Beijing and Lagos, etc., wanting this to happen, but, you know, didn't really see it. But one thing I found really interesting is the hand-wringing from government in Britain and Emmanuel Macron in France, and then you had European commissioners. And you've got to say, where were these people 20 or 30 years ago? Because this has been the direction of travel for, I would say, at least two decades. It kind of feels like it's of the moment, and, you know, they handled it so badly. The kind of government, the populist government we have in Great Britain at the moment, Boris Johnson's own issues with non-footballing matters, should we say. There was potential sleaze inquiry last week. This was a real open goal that you could seize as a you know, won all of the seats up north as well. There was a lot of football support up there, and there was no opposition. There were no advocates for this project. So suddenly government is up in arms. How many statements from Boris Johnson on football we've had in the last 48 hours? You know, we've been distracted from everything else. But if this game, if they're sincere, big if this game is that important, they've realised, to the social fabric of the United Kingdom and in Europe, etc., are we going to see safeguards? Are we going to see legislation? Are we going to see the European Union get involved and make specific provisions to stop billionaires, millionaires, whoever, entrepreneurs, from taking teams away to competitions that aren't part of the pyramid, which arguably is part of the social fabric of Europe? You know, whether you're playing on Sunday in London, in Germany or France, there is that. Obviously, Gianni Infantino made that point, I think, in his speech at the UEFA Congress, that you're still all allied. There is a line that tracks the game, the Champions League final, to Hackney Marshes. There is that line. Obviously, it's a fantasy that you could, you know, one day you could do it, but it exists. So what you're talking about is this great rupture, and now we got so close to it. They ruined it in 48 hours, but they had it all in place. We got so close to the rupture. Have people had their eyes open to say, right, come on, let's get our heads together and make a plan so this type of thing doesn't happen again? We might get a better football out of it. Who knows?
I mean, pandemic era, we've seen a lot of government intervention. How much does it cost to underwrite a 50+1 rule in the UK? A lot, maybe more than anyone would countenance if they saw it in a headline, but worth thinking about. Anyway, we'll take a break there and we will see what Matt Slater has to say about all of this. And we'll be back with you again in just a sec.
Hello, I'm Matt Rogan. I've spent my career creating and scaling businesses in sports and entertainment. And now I'm talking to smart leaders inside and outside sport to get their ideas on managing change and building towards a better future. You can listen in on the Playbook podcast, a collection of candid, agenda-free conversations full of practical advice your company can work with. Get your new episodes right here on the Sports Pro feed and check out the rest of the series wherever you get your podcasts.
Matt Slater, football news reporter for The Athletic. Welcome back to the Sports Pro podcast again.
Hello.
Matt, what just happened?
Well, are we allowed to talk about the one we did yesterday? Are we pretending that didn't happen? A bit like the Super League.
Well, I can think, yeah, exactly. I can think of some people who would like to pretend it didn't happen. But what did happen? How did the threads come apart so quickly?
Oh, great question. How did the threads come apart? Well, okay, right. Bullet point answer then. Because it wasn't a very well thought through plan in the first place. There were obvious holes and flaws in it. So that begs the question, did they mean it? Did all of them mean it? You know, you can't have a Super League with only three countries represented, seven cities, no Germany, no France, two big markets. They hadn't sorted out the mechanism for those five clubs, which is really important because it couldn't be a closed league. If it was a closed league, they were never going to get regulatory approval from FIFA, and therefore it would have been a breakaway league. And if that was the case, all kinds of legal and sort of regulatory governmental consequences would have flown from there. For example, the police might not have had to police your event. So, you know, and 18 other, you know, consequences too. So there's that. Were all of them as on board as the others? No, we knew that. We knew that there were last ones in and more reluctant ones and ones who just sort of felt they had to be part of the conversation. They couldn't risk being left out. So there was always an opportunity that you could pick a couple off. And that became pretty clear on Monday and Tuesday that that's where the kind of pressure would come, both from UEFA and Premier League, that they would be talking to clubs who were perhaps less committed to this plan than others. I think we also have to acknowledge politics and government and the very quick and bandwagon-esque, dare I say, but, you know, fair enough, loud, clear, unequivocal response from governments in France and the UK mainly, but also, you know, the noises from Brussels and the European Commission, that had a role. And then I think, finally, fans. Well done, fans. The fans of these clubs made it pretty obvious to their owners, who are absentee owners and hadn't been consulted and hadn't been listening and hadn't read the room, well, the fans made it clear, certainly in this country, certainly in England. And then that, of course, then feeds into sponsors and what have you. And we even had last night, before they all did the honourable thing, we had the first of the sponsors saying they'd pull out. And there will be implications of any deals that are pending. Considerable reputational damage across the board, really. So I think it's a variety of poor plan, not fully thought through, a range of commitments to the plan, strength of opposition, perfect storm, and it didn't survive it.
I mean, the ruins of this, and you know, we spent a lot of time when we thought this was still going to be a threat, even if it was only a threat, trying to unpack some of the motivations of the people involved. But the ruins of it, as you say, can be read now. Ruins is probably the wrong expression, but you could kind of, you could do the archaeology of it, I guess, now by looking at who wasn't involved and when. The fact that they went into this without Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund and Paris Saint-Germain, Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund could never really have done this outside of an existing framework because of the fan ownership of their clubs. And PSG had their political motivations, I guess. But as soon as those three were left inside the UEFA family, their incentive is, well, why don't we stay with these incredibly lucrative competitions that we're already in, instead of, you know, risking it all and risking on a concept that's quite thin, let's be generous. And then, as you say, I mean, a couple of the more heavily backed clubs in the Premier League, Chelsea and Man City, there was talk, what, Monday? That they were, you know, theoretically along for the ride more than they weren't ride or die, put it that way.
Yeah.
And from there, you kind of see the dominoes tumble. But I think, you know, the point you make is that the motivations of the different clubs were not the same. Some are in financial dire straits. Some have a kind of strategic vision investment in something like this happening one day, and some just didn't want to see the train go by.
Yeah, completely. Absolutely. That's it. I think you've just nailed it. So if we sort of unpack some of that, Real Madrid, who've been, particularly Florentino Perez, if we want to put a name on it, have been at the center of these rumors for a decade. He's made no bones about it. They feel they've outgrown La Liga. It's got personal between him and La Liga boss Javier Tebas. You can just see it in the reaction in Spain today. I was asking a friend there, you know, is it being reported in the same way that it's been reported in England? And not really. I mean, Barcelona Atletico are getting it from their fans, but the media reaction is that the Premier League and Qatar have knifed the ESL. I just find that staggering. But I think it goes to show that Real Madrid, and I guess Barca as well, but are bigger than La Liga. Mm. And devotion to that cause supersedes all others. So you've got that. And then you have, let's have a look at our Italian friends. Well, Serie A is a mess. The competitive balance in Europe has swung massively in my lifetime. There's been no real investment in Italian infrastructure, apart from Juventus' stadium, since the Italian World Cup in 1990. The revenues of the revenue gap to the Premier League and to Bayern and Barca and Real has gone wrong. They've had struggles getting TV deals and private equity deals over the line. And a number of people on Monday sort of before we sort of got wind that this could all fall apart on Tuesday, were wondering why the Premier League clubs were getting into bed and hitching their wagons to Serie A clubs. You know, why would you do that? You don't need to. So why would you risk it all? Your streets ahead, certainly in terms of off the pitch. So there's that. Then you've got, I think, your third group, the American-owned clubs, who these guys have clubs in the North American sports system. And it's Arsenal, Liverpool and Man United, of course, in England. But I would also add AC Milan to that. They are run by a US private equity firm. And this, I think, goes to sort of a narrative that's been out there for a while. You know, we've let them in and they talk a good game and they, you know, they've obviously brought something to the party and all that. But ultimately, are they going to try and recreate North American sport in Europe? Are they, you know, are we going to head to a franchise system, closed leagues, NFL, NBA, MLS? Are they really comfortable with relegation, the concept of relegation? Or for them, really, it's more, you know, not qualifying for the Champions League. And they've revealed their hand now, you know, that no, they're not comfortable with it. They don't like it. It's a disaster for their business model, that level of uncertainty. What we would call jeopardy, what we think is great and exciting about the European football sports model, that no, there's a pyramid. And if you're good, merit, you earn good stuff, i.e. Champions League football. And if you're no good, if you make a series of bad decisions, well, tough.
Mm.
Now, I think those are the competing, if you like, motives and agendas here. And then, you know, you've got, as you said, you mentioned the well-backed clubs, well-resourced clubs that you know, you sell Chelsea and Man City, who I did think it was fear of missing out and that almost kind of like playground thing. What's going on over there? I better just go find out what's going on over there because it looks pretty good. And yeah, so you have this disparate group. It's herding cats, isn't it? And unless you've got an amazing plan, and they didn't have an amazing plan, then it's hard keeping all that lot together.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a fair bit of conversation and again, it's something we spent some time talking about in a different context about this, but around the communication plan or lack thereof. The fact that we had this coordinated launch, but then no advocates, no second answer, no third answer, no fourth answer. Nobody outside the room, basically, who had been asked or been told or been you know, and that came apart quite quickly. But I think, I guess what it shows is that you need something that people are invested in to be able to communicate it in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And doesn't that say something? It says two things. If you haven't really done the hard yards in terms of PR and here's what we're going to be saying on day one, here's we're ready for day two, we're ready for day three, here's what we're saying in like a month down the road. If you haven't really kind of nailed all that, then how serious was this? Was this just meant to be the same old story? We use it as a threat, right, to gain concessions from UEFA to have the moves and the changes we want in the Champions League. It's that, right? So let's not go overboard on the preparations, right? So there's that element to this, which I have felt from the beginning, and I must admit I didn't think they'd do what they did on Sunday, so I got that wrong. But how it's played out is kind of what I was expecting. That this wasn't a very well thought through plan, and they hadn't done the hard yards to make it better. But then I think the other element is just what that says about their arrogance and how disengaged they are and how they've missed, certainly the English clubs, how they've misread the room so badly. And we've now had a couple of apologies, not, you know, belated and not brilliant. And we've sort of seen this sort of, we've seen John W. Henry do his video for the Liverpool website. And it's not his first apology. And yet he seems to be making the same mistakes. And he's supposed to be one of the more savvy ones. You know, the Glazers are supposed to be the ones that have just completely detached from reality. Stan Kroenke's supposed to be the kind of, you know, odd and silent and just, you know, this sort of, I don't know, unapproachable bloke. But, you know, John W. Henry in the past has sort of seemed okay. He's, you know, he's done all right with the Boston Red Sox. Liverpool have been successful. He's given fans kind of what they want. But he keeps making these terrible, terrible decisions. And I'm just staggered at the sort of catalogue of errors Fenway Sports Group have made in the last few years, be it, you know, season ticket prices, furloughing, Project Big Picture, this. What are they doing? Do they talk to anybody? They don't appear to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, it's been really striking that how few people were engaged in this process. And the two pieces that I keep trying to put together, and as you say, I think it's probably whether they've kind of thrown a wild haymaker and left themselves exposed, or whether there was a bit of calculation in this and they've just kind of slightly overdone it on the, you know, the political side of things. They really didn't let many people into the circle. Managers were not told about it. Players were not told about it. But those were the first spokespeople for these clubs, with a couple of exceptions, who were out in the media. And then you saw how quickly the responses from players were coordinated. Yesterday, you had the entire Liverpool team, you know, I guess as soon as they got wind of the fact that the edifice was crumbling, you know, tweeting out responses. You have players from other clubs. There was talk that this kind of informal group of Premier League captains that formed during the pandemic was convened to discuss this, because, you know, these guys have pretty big contracts and they don't want to be in breach of them, and they don't want to be but equally they don't want to suddenly have their value diluted because they can only sign for 15 clubs, or they can, you know, there'll be XLs and Rebels and all the rest of it. And you saw partners, the reaction from partners has been absolutely incandescent. If you kind of pass the corporate language around it. And actually now you're seeing, I think it was Heineken today, have done a couple of jokes. One being, this is the only 12 pack that should be on sale, with their beers photographed on Instagram on one account. And then the other one was, be careful what plans you make while drinking, words to that effect, please consume responsibly.
Yeah.
You know, this is, people were not consulted. It's a very, yeah, very mismatched approach.
Print, digital, events, podcasts, Sports Pro.
What does this tell us about what's left? I mean, we can talk about the kind of, you know, what people didn't get and what what has snuck through this week in terms of the balance of power among European clubs. But first of all, what does this tell us about where the strengths are in the European system and the European pyramid?
I mean, good question. Well, I've been talking to people about this, whether the sort of good vibes, the sort of sense of joy I have is right at the moment. I mean, because something awful was presented to us, and now it's been taken away. Should we be grateful for that, or should we continue to be angry and annoyed that awful thing very nearly happened, and some people still think it should happen and it's okay? And in the meantime, some quite radical changes have gone through to the Champions League, right? That there wasn't a great deal of consultation with fans, none really. Those big clubs have got a pretty sweet deal for such treachery. You know, they're going to, if you'd have asked them, certainly publicly, what they wanted a couple of weeks ago, well, they've pretty much got that. So, you know, what does that say about power and who's in charge? It does sort of suggest that these guys can behave badly, act in bad faith, and make terrible decisions, and yet still come out smelling like roses. So that's quite depressing, isn't it? However, if we're going to be more optimistic about things, fans still matter. Fans matter, and that's great. You know, would this have unraveled as quickly? I think it would have. I just think it was fundamentally flawed. But would it have unraveled like it unraveled yesterday without the response of fans? No. So well done, fans. And also the Premier League, La Liga, the domestic leagues, those two in particular, stood up to it. So, you know, the institutions, but the left behind clubs didn't cave in and start panicking and, oh, what more concessions can we make to these guys? So there was some trust and faith in the system, in the pyramid still. Okay, there was, of course, self-interest driving all of that. Self-interest drives everything in sport. But so there was still some faith in the Premier League being at the pinnacle of a pyramid. And UEFA as well. You know, UEFA, who have made mistakes through this process, and, you know, if we're going to have a proper post-mortem, we need to talk about what's happened over the last couple of years, didn't blink either. And it does appear they're going to be magnanimous, and we're going to sort of try and move on. So in amongst all of the bad stuff and really worrying stuff that's happened, there's still bits there that you can go, yeah, it's still sport, it's still football, it's still a game where you are rewarded if you do well at it. And, you know, there are sort of sporting punishments, i.e. relegation and not qualifying for things if you do not so well at it. So the whole thing hasn't been trashed. It's just been, there's been some bad behaviour and a dreadful idea that thankfully has gone away, and hopefully gone away for a bit. It will come back. It will come back, I promise you. But hopefully not for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I suppose one of the things that we've learned is the balance between what exists and what theoretically exists in football, especially because every sport is going to have some version of this conversation, you know, over the next few years as the balance of their incomes changes. But in football, especially, this is the sport that everybody else wants to be commercially, first and foremost. And whether this group of owners is dissatisfied with the share that they get or the stability that they get, the scale of opportunity in football is pretty much unmatched. It's, you know, there is a shop on every corner, to use a crude commercial term. There are clubs everywhere and there are fan bases everywhere. And that really is, that's the health of it. And, you know, the rest you can kind of tinker with, but, you know, that really is the position that it's in. I guess there will be clubs who will have thought again a bit, and the vociferousness of the response will have given them pause on this. But a few people have said in the last year, Phil Carling and Tim Crowe, I think, are a couple of them, but that there is a kind of lazy assumption that because there are hundreds of millions of people watching football around the world, it is as valuable to you to try and court the people who are furthest away more than the people who are nearest to you. Because someone who buys a season ticket, yes, there are fewer people who buy season tickets. Yes, there are fewer people who watch on Sky in the UK. But the actual value of that fan monetarily, as well as culturally, spiritually, whatever you want to say, because there's you know, you can talk until the cows come home about the latter. But at the moment, you have a better chance, if you look after the fans who are closest to you first, of actually surviving and, you know, sustainably as a football club.
Yep. I completely agree. This is the conundrum, isn't it? Local versus global. You know, so for decades, for most of football, professional football's history, these have been local businesses, right? My town versus your town. That's what's driven this. And then, you know, TV technology, the internet, etc. The popularity of the game has turned it into something else and has opened new opportunities, has made these clubs bigger, richer, wealthier, but has also posed serious questions about how these games are organised and governed, has made people greedy, or you could flip it and just say ambitious, fiduciary responsibilities to sort of grow their businesses and to future-proof themselves. You know, again, if you want to sort of be more kind to these guys, fine, I've got no problem with that. But what the big debate is, and I think you're absolutely right, it's this: these big clubs, they look at their numbers, their social media numbers, which in other sectors they're being told is everything, right? If you're going to do an IPO, if you're a tech stock, if you're some sort of retail brand, you know, what's your reach and all that? And they're going, well, we've got massive reach. We've got amazing brands. Look at our staff. Look who we've got on our payroll. You know, we kill this lot. Why are we not a market darling? Why are banks not banging on our door trying to lend us money? Give us money. You know, this should be easy. We're massive. And yet, relatively speaking, they're still relatively small businesses. I mean, the old joke used to be these Premier League clubs, you know, turn over less money than your local supermarket. They're doing a bit better than that now, but not much better. No one cares about the Sainsbury's down the road from me, but they actually turn over quite a lot of money and they actually employ quite a few people. Everyone cares about Man United, apparently, as we have just demonstrated, as they have just demonstrated over the last 72 hours. But are they getting the massive multiple in terms of their valuation? And no, they're not. Right. So how do you do that? What do they do about that? Well, they've got to monetize that floating 95% of their Twitter following that aren't coming to their games, aren't buying official merchandise, aren't paying for a Sky subscription, all of that stuff. And it's hard. No one's saying this stuff is easy, but have the way they've just chosen to go about it, was that any better? Did they really thought that through? What was the fundamental business model of this European Super League, which, don't forget, was in the same midweek evening slots as the Champions League, which is middle of the morning in Far East and lunchtime on the West Coast of the US. So, you know, what were they doing? Why were they going to make so much more money out of this than UEFA? So I understand the conundrum. And it is a conundrum, and they've got plenty of bright people that work for them. And if they don't, they can hire consultants that are endlessly coming up with reports about what they can do and the engagement and how they, be it, you know, shops in China or summer tours or clips packages, whatever, or any other kind of, you know, stuff, sticking stuff on their own in-house channels. And it's all happening. It's not happening quick enough, clearly. And they all don't like losing money, and COVID's obviously hurt. But I just think the Super League was not a particularly brilliant answer to that global, local, undervalued question.
Yeah. What comes next, Matt? You haven't got long, but what comes next we're going to see a bit of a rapprochement between the clubs and UEFA, I'm sure. But in terms of these owners, particularly those with more of an investment kind of profile, do they think, right, this is maybe the time for me to get out?
Well, good. Yeah. So what happens is, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't think there's any real appetite at UEFA to crucify this lot. I think some of the individuals are going to struggle. They have badly burned bridges, and you know, the guys, people like Andrea Agnelli, you know, he should stay away from Seferin. Seferin's got a black belt in karate. But the institutions, I think UEFA will be very keen to just move on and just, but we've got a deal. We did a deal behind you, you know, without you. We did a deal with the ECA, the other 240 leading clubs in Europe. We've spent 2 years on this Champions League restructure. Should we crack on with that as agreed, as you told us you agreed with? So I think there'll be movement there. Premier League will be interesting. Premier League will be interesting because I think there's a very possible and sound, plausible case that some of the individuals involved at these clubs have breached the owners and directors test, for example. They have behaved, they've acted in poor faith. They've not acted in good faith with their colleagues and with the league itself. They have sat in on meetings and committees, and they've had confidential and commercially sensitive information shared with them, whilst the whole time having done a sneaky deal that will damage the Premier League's value. So I think watch this space. So I think there could be some individuals that can no longer carry on in their posts. We've already seen Ed Woodward go, or you know, say he's going. I don't think he'll be the last. Now, the ownerships of these groups. So let's be honest, this has been driven by the ownerships. Will they be forced to sell? I don't know. I think that would be difficult, the forcing, the compelling. Will they choose to sell? Will they finally read the room and realize that they have so badly damaged relationships with colleagues, peers, but perhaps also broadcast partners and commercial partners? Will they sort of think, we made a bad bet and we need to go, and perhaps this is a good time to go? I think that's very possible. I think some of these clubs were for sale anyway, to be honest with you, Owen. And you know, this was sort of part of the exit strategy, and maybe the exit strategy just changes now as just a sort of like, oh God, well, we've just been, you know, we've got that catastrophically wrong. We should sell and do something else. So I expect the fallout from this is going to be really, really interesting.
And also, just, you know, will they want to sell? Because they might have thought this was their opportunity to add value to their investment. This was their gambit, and they don't really know how to make money from football clubs in the traditional way that they won.
The share prices of United and Juve, the sort of listed ones, went up on the news, and then when they went down on the... So the market's sort of quite like this. I wonder if the market, because the market often, people, you know, read way too much into one-day fluctuations in share prices. I wonder if that would have drifted down anyway when people realised, one, how hard this was going to be and how, you know, flaky the plan was. But the immediate response was, oh, Super League, good. Oh, collapse the Super League, bad. But I think you make a good point. You know, some of these guys have owned these clubs for a while. They've got to this point. Okay, no one predicted COVID, but they've almost sort of run out of steam and run out of ideas a bit. So maybe it's time to let someone else have a crack.
We shall see. Anyway, Matt, thanks as ever for your time. Thanks for doing this again as well.
the hidden episode.
All right, take care.
All right, then. Take care. Bye.
Help us spread the word about the Sports Pro Podcast. Subscribe, like and share our content on social. Join the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag SportsProPod. And if you're enjoying our work, why not leave us a rating and a nice review on your podcast platform of choice? And if you want to get in touch, you can send us an email, podcast@sportspromedia.com. The Sports Pro Podcast. We're listening too.
Welcome back to the Sports Pro Podcast. Thank you to Matt Slater for his time there, his rearranged time in a very hectic week. Guys, let's have some final thoughts before we go our separate ways. Sam, how would you bring all of this together?
Thanks for that one. Well, I think what's going to be interesting for me is kind of, you know, how this unfolds from this point onwards. You know, how those, I'd love to be a fly on the wall at the next Premier League meeting, for example, when those six clubs kind of enter back into the room sheepishly with their tails firmly between their legs, you know, or not. Maybe they might not be ashamed of this at all. And whether there are some, you know, sanctions handed down by UEFA. I think it also shouldn't be brushed under the carpet that this week, you know, we have ushered in this new Champions League format, which, you know, in a sense, these clubs have got some of what they want. There are going to be more games between the top teams, as you
got almost all of what they want.
Well, yeah, there are some legacy spaces in there, and you know, let's not pretend that the Champions League hasn't been somewhat of a closed shop for a long time. You know, you get a lot of the same clubs qualifying every year. You get teams finishing in fourth in England qualifying while the champions in other European countries aren't getting in. You know, I guess that's maybe a whole other argument to have for another time. But also, I think something interesting that this whole saga has kind of raised again is, and in a way, it's almost a shame that it didn't go make its way to the courts, because I think the answer would have been quite interesting in terms of the outcome, is, you know, it kind of comes back to that point of, it's something that you wrote about in our magazine, and is who runs sport now. You know, if this had gone to the court and they had ruled in favour of the clubs, it would have had really broad implications for sport more generally, in terms of, you know, what governing bodies have the autonomy to do. And, you know, football, let's not pretend it's the only sport where there are these threats of breakaways at the moment. You've had swimming in recent years. There was a ruling with the International Skating Union at the end of last year which was against the governing body when they tried to stop their athletes competing in unsanctioned events. So I think it would have been really interesting to just see this play out for that reason, in terms of, you know, the autonomy that these sports bodies do actually have and what they can and can't do. So yeah, that's one question that goes unanswered, but I think it's an interesting side to this.
Yeah. Nick?
I mean, look, I still think there's a lot more to come out. We're going to find out more about who else was behind the scenes, how serious this was of a campaign and an initiative. I'm just really excited to see what happens over the next couple of weeks as well, just to find out more about what was going on. Because with everyone still questioning the logic and the process, and like this conversation has proven that. So, yeah, it's not every club has basically put themselves in a more precarious position than they were, whether it's financially or otherwise. There's clubs like Inter and Barcelona that are in huge debt positions. I mean, what's this mean for them now? This was supposed to be a bit of a helping hand, so to speak, for them to get out of some of their debt troubles. What's the future hold for them? Is receivership and going to be down the line for them? Who knows? So look, yeah, the situation of European football now is in a crazy position now. And I'm really looking, from an outsider looking in, I'm very looking forward to following a story, but I'm a bit concerned at what's going to happen with some of these big clubs over the coming 12 to 18 months.
Tarek?
Yeah, I guess the downfall of these 12 elite clubs is really interesting, because for years we've been told that they can essentially do whatever they want, and they haven't been able to do it this time. So it creates this little window. I don't know how long this window will last. Seferin was elected in 2016 on a promise of being a more egalitarian president, a champion of the middle-sized and smaller clubs. Now, if ever there is a time for a bit of redistribution, adding a bit more competitive balance into the competition, these guys have got nowhere else to go. They've just had the most incredible flop in modern times, I'd say. This is humiliating. I can't imagine them saying in 2 weeks, sorry, we don't like what you've done, we're going to start Super League. That for at least a short while is disappeared. So there's this great moment. And I said earlier, one for legislation, one for governments, et cetera, to bring in rules to tame the marketplace and to tame these people. The other for football's governing bodies to maybe equalize the playing field a little bit in a way that we might get to see some more challenges emerge. We might see the end of an attempt to end the procession of these teams that are always the same teams winning the leagues and ending up in European competition. I'm not going to hold my breath though, but that's what I hope they'll take the advantage.
Well, lots to look out for. Hopefully it will unfold at a slightly more controllable pace for our sanity and our schedules over the next few weeks. But yeah, tons to unpack. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Nick has had to dash off already. I imagine there is some kind of parenting duty that awaits him on the other end of that line. But thank you to Matt Slater. Thank you to you, Tarek Panja, for your contributions throughout the week, some of which have gone unrecorded by history, but will be very much remembered by us.
Yeah, thank you, Owen. What a half a week we've had together. So looking forward to seeing you after a longer rest.
And thanks to you, Sam Karp.
Cheers, Owen. Thanks very much for having me on.
Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back with you again very soon. Bye-bye.
The Sports Pro podcast is published by Sports Pro Media. The producer is Ed Dixon.